Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and we have a very special guest with us today. And this is part two, and I am thrilled to be joined by John Buddy. He is the breeder and the mastermind of Tartan Sight Collies. He is an AKC judge, and he brings fully a half a century of breeding knowledge to the conversation. So I think you guys are going to find a lot of really good and really valuable information to take away from this conversation. And if you didn't have a chance, you can take a listen to part one that we did last week. We're going into a discussion of virtues, and never give up virtues when you're doing a breeding and preserving the virtues of the breed. People talk about virtues a lot. And I think many of the times, new folks, some of the younger people, people that are newer to breeding and the sport, it's hard for them to understand virtues versus faults and why virtues are so important. So can you kind of expand on that some? I think this is a really important point. And the fact that, you know, this dog is cowhawk, but it has this amazing one thing, kind of speak to that a little bit.
I think we use the term virtue all the time, but I think oftentimes to a newcomer, it is a bit of lip service. Mm-hmm. And a real lack of understanding on that. But I've also found it to be the same with certain breeders that have, you know, a couple of years in there, but mostly due to kennel blind, for lack of a better term. You know, I've watched people come along who get involved with a particular family of dogs because they really like specific characteristics that are very noteworthy in that particular family. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, after they have a little success, they want to sort of do their own thing. And so they maybe do some outcrosses. Some people are very good at it, and some fail. And I often find that those who fail want to breed into one family because it's fashionable and it's currently winning or it's very showy. And yet it doesn't have the virtues that their bitch was line bred for in the first place. Mm-hmm. But they still talk about it as if it's there. And when the selection process comes, they're more apt to select for the new qualities that they were after and don't put the priorities on maintenance and maintaining the very virtues that they were lucky enough to have in the beginning. And so the dogs that they have in the newer generations don't resemble the older ones because, you know, they may have an added virtue or characteristic, but they've lost the all-important ones that they started out with and yet continue to give lip service to.
Interesting. The point about selection and that's what separates great breeders from good ones. And I think that what you're just saying is very interesting to me because I always say I'm doing this breeding for a reason and that I should select the puppy that represents the reason I did this breeding. So I went to it for a better, I don't know, whatever, eye color, eye shape, ear set, I don't know. But I love what you're saying about don't lose what you had, making perfect the enemy of the good. Something right along those lines.
You know, I think it's absolutely every breeding should be done in hopes of achieving something. But there's a certain balance in the selection process that's just as important. And that balance has to do with not losing some of the good virtues that have been bred into what you have so far. I find this happens a lot when people do outcrosses. Mm-hmm. They'll have a puppy or a bitch that is either line bred from generations of their own breeding or from someone else's. And then they want that improvement, which is perfectly normal. But the important thing is don't put so much emphasis on that new added characteristic that you lose sight of, you know, what you've worked so hard to achieve up to that point.
Right. And following up on that, one of your rules on this list is when you're doing those outcrosses, which we know every now and then everybody needs to do them, to breed to type. So type to type. So you find something style-wise that is similar to what you have. Is that what you're advocating?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, and don't always breed in extremes. Occasionally, an extreme breeding will work where you can breed to something different. But the other thing with doing outcrosses is you really don't always get your results until the generation after the one you've done.
Correct.
And the key to being successful, the people who have been most successful, are often breeders who really get that notion of breeding and realize that it's what they do with that outcrossed generation that makes or breaks them.
Right. Absolutely. I can speak to that from personal experience. So yes, absolutely. The other one I thought was really interesting, and it goes back to talking, for me anyway, it goes back to talking about selection, that puppy development differs. Like my line versus your line versus my neighbor's line.
Right.
That differs. And so part of your selection process has to be knowing your own line. But then how do you work with, say, that outcross and say, I don't know anything about the puppy development in that line? What's your recommendation about dealing with that?
I think if you're going to do an outcross, I would talk to the sire owner. I would spend some time at their house or kennel or, you know, at dog shows and start looking at, you know, we don't do puppy matches like we used to. When I was growing up on this, Long Island was a hotbed of dog breeders, and there were match shows of all types almost every weekend.
Right.
And during those, you got to see different families grow up. But then, of course, you know, you might want to breed to a dog that's halfway across the country and you don't have the opportunity. And I've often said the three keys to being successful breeding are selection, selection, selection. But along with that comes the fact that you really need to take time to really observe and evaluate puppies at various ages. And in the beginning, I used to grow puppies out till 6, 7, 8 months just to find out how they developed. And, you know, sometimes litter mates grew out differently so that you don't get rid of one too early or too late. And eventually during that process, of course, a lot of them would get to be 6 and 7 months and have to go to a pet home.
Right.
But you also have to be smart enough to realize they're good, but maybe not good enough, and be honest with yourself. You know, do you want the best of the best, or do you want the best of what you have?
And I think that is a great point. Maybe you can expand on this for me a little bit. Talking to people and watching my own litters over the years, the best puppy in litter X may very well be not as good as the worst puppy in litter Y.
Absolutely. I mean, you just put the nail on the head. And, you know, I've had litters of breeding a non-champion to another non-champion and then had double champion breedings and felt that the non-champion sire and dam litter, there were a couple of puppies in there that were better than the other ones. So the titles themselves really didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially, you know, I grew up, as I said, in New York City. I had to make every breeding count because I couldn't keep a lot of dogs. And so I used to make a list of what I felt the dam had, what I felt the sire had, and what were the things I most wanted to keep a puppy for in the litter. And when they would come and you'd watch them grow up, you know, you waited till an age where it was appropriate to evaluate them. Collies are long-headed dogs, but at 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, they're still very short-headed. The heads haven't really lengthened, and the chests haven't dropped and things like that. So you also have to decide what age is ideal to select a puppy.
And that varies certainly from breed to breed.
And even within the breed, family to family.
That's what I was just going to say. I have my particular line and a girlfriend and I, and we kind of go back and forth looking at each other's dogs. And what I see at 6 weeks, I often won't see in her puppies until 9 weeks or, you know, whatever it is. And it's just so important to know that. And I think I know I can speak from personal experience from having petted out a dog that then, you know, I saw it 6 months and I just wanted to jump a bridge, right?
Right.
So the value that you're offering here that is hang on to it, you know, if it's interesting and maybe the this, that, or the other. Like in my case, I placed a dog with an undershot mouth that came around. So what are you going to do?
Right. I noticed today too that people ask me to look at puppies or litter, and those people that know me well know how I am, where, you know, I'll have them put in an X-Pen, and I just sit and watch them for a while, whereas a lot of the newcomers right away grab them and pick them up and go over their profiles, look for a correct stop and correct head planes and things like that at ages when it's not even appropriate. But the more important thing is, I'm never in a rush. I like to watch their demeanor and how they interact with each other, how they hold themselves, whether they stand over their ground, you know, how they use their legs and their feet, and look at their expression without pulling their ears up on their head, making it as natural as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I often think sometimes people rush to judgment. And again, some people, they'll evaluate puppies at 10 weeks old and they'll pigeonhole them. They'll pick out one particular puppy they like or dislike. And that is the picture that they carry in their mind forever.
Mm-hmm. Yes, also valid. Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons-only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details. The other thing, and speak to me about this, and I think this is, I had a very, very similar conversation to what you're describing. I spoke with Sue Hubner, a Poolie breeder in Australia, and she made a lot of these same comments and observations. And I wonder how you feel. I watch puppies grow, right? Like we all watch our puppies grow up and we're constantly evaluating in the whelping box. And then you want to see some structure and you put them on the table and you see things in photos that you don't necessarily see when they're just running around like crazy dogs. So how do you feel about that in terms of as you're making those evaluations? Do you think the photos are more realistic or what you see on the ground?
I think when you're looking at photos, as I said, there's a certain static balance mm-hmm. that a dog is set up and put on a table.
Mm-hmm.
Legs can be placed to be better than mm-hmm. others. And sometimes I'm sort of amazed at what people think is correct and not. You know, we have a thing in our breed where a lot of times you'll see collies with their rear quarter set way out back behind them.
Right.
And it's a very eye-catching pose, but it's also very incorrect.
Right.
And if the rear quarters were placed where they should be, you know, with the hocks coming down under the pin bone and tail set, the dog would obviously be higher in the rear and lower in the shoulder.
Mm.
And these are things, if you just watch puppies, that's what I mean, you know, don't rush to judgment. Let them walk around, see how they stand over the ground, see how they place their legs, and do it at a couple of different ages. And I think you'll learn a great deal more that way. This is a breed, too, for me. Collies are not a breed that you stack anyway.
Right.
So
right.
Natural stance is much more important.
Right. And again, maybe not as something for collies, but I know for my breed with movement, I'm always looking for that puppy that only trots and rarely gallops. That just to me indicates balance when they're on their feet, when they're moving around. Is that something you see in your breed as well?
I don't know if I notice that as much, but the biggest thing, the word that always comes to mind when I watch them move, even as little puppies, is effortless. You know, a collie should be able to work all day as a herding breed. So, you know, I do think you'll find sometimes a puppy that's not built as well will probably start to gallop because it probably would not be able to have just a very effortless gait ongoing for a long period of time.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with speed. It's really the quality of time that it can maintain this effortless movement.
Right. So I think we've really touched a lot about the patience and being able to watch these dogs. And I think it's one of the most difficult things. Like we mentioned earlier that everybody wants to finish their puppy at 6 months, but can you give some recommendations for people that have a very promising young dog and they just desperately want to show it right this minute? You know, ways that they can let the dog reach its full potential before they get too carried away with it.
I come from an era when the optimum time to show a dog was 3. Mm-hmm. And you're right about, you know, this early finishing syndrome that's mm-hmm. taken over to get them done as quick. The sad thing is that people get them done and then they don't know what to do, so they start on the next one. And then again, we come into the numbers game.
Right.
One of my favorite stories, two people who were very influential in my life and became really close friends, had a champion that they were so proud of, they would tell people, because he won the Collie Club of Maryland 3 times.
Mm.
And most people assume it was his special, but it wasn't. He went winner's dog there 3 years, and that's how he finished, because they were raising 4 children, and they didn't show maybe 2 shows a year. That was the best that it did, and the dog just got better and better with age. And I come from an era also of bench shows, where I would have to stay all day and look at dogs on the bench, and even though I might have had a preconceived notion that this one had too strong a head or not quite as good an eye or ear or anything. But you know what? When you're sitting opposite them on a bench for several hours, you get to really evaluate and you see the qualities that you might not have seen otherwise. But you also get to watch them mature.
Right.
And it was always kind of a wonderful thing to watch, but I think people are afraid if they don't get them finished right away, they won't be any good or whatever. And I think a lot of it has to do with it's just getting the points and not really appreciating the dog show itself, the evaluation process, who you showed to, and what a difference it made.
I can give you an amen on that because I can't agree anymore. That is, I think, so important.
Well, some of the older judges on occasion would say something to me about a particular young dog, and they'd say, boy, I would love to see this one when it grows up. And that meant as much as a 5-point major. It maybe only went 2nd in the class at that particular time, but they could see the potential.
Yes.
And potential isn't always the same thing as the quality on the day. But nonetheless, if you really go to dog shows for the opinion and someone mentions that and the person is someone who you respect, it's very meaningful.
Perfect example. Michelle Billings, one of my dog show gods as a kid, who saw a particular dog at a national specialty, gave it reserve, said he was like 2 years old, said, bring it back to me when he grows up. And 2 years later, gave him a group.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of things, right? Like that opinion meant a lot to me. And she found him easily, handily, no problem. But in closing, as we're kind of wrapping this up, speak a little bit to, because a lot of my listeners out here are folks that are relatively new to dogs. I mean, I have a broad audience, but I'd say the majority are people that are just sort of learning, getting started in the sport. What encouragement, what suggestions, what ideas can you offer to people that are just getting started, that are where you were 50 years ago?
I think in some way, I guess I was somewhat of a Pollyanna because...
I still am, honey. Don't worry about it.
I always believed that if you worked hard enough and did the right things and studied, that you would have an equal chance in the show ring as anybody else. And, you know, I used to go to a lot of handling classes, but more importantly, I used to sit and watch people all the time, you know, the top handlers. What did they do that was different from someone else? And so I would begin to emulate the things that they did. I think it's also important, and something that's lacking today, is have heroes. You know, I mean, my dad was a big Yankees fan when I was a kid, and we spent a lot of time at Yankee Stadium, and he had his heroes. Mine was at the dog show world, and I would find people in my breed and in other breeds. And because they were my heroes, I wanted to find out what made them tick, how they acted, emulate their whole professionalism and so forth, you know, and try and get to know them. And that never changed till the day many of them passed on. They were still my heroes. I would never put myself in the same category as them. But there's so much to be learned from people like that, that made them great in the way that they were. You mentioned like Pat Trotter, who has become a good friend over the years. But she was someone in her breed who she did it all.
Yes.
And she believed that she could win as well as any professional handler. And I spent a lot of Westminster's watching her win groups and things as an owner handler. And, you know, those things were gratifying. It's important to keep yourself stimulated by being inspired, and just make sure you're inspired by the right person who really believes in the sanctity of the breed and the sanctity of the sport.
Yeah, that right there. I think that's really beautiful and leads us to our final practice, courtesy, and respect. So I think that is one of the best rules yet, and sportsmanship and the things that are what make this sport worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I've always said that the really top breeders in any particular breed share the three R's: respect, reverence, and romance. The respect of the individuals that came before you, the respect for your given standard, followed by the reverence of just finding some of these special people and these special dogs and holding them in high regard, which leads to the third R, which is romance. There is a certain romance about the early days in your breed, and studying the lore of the breed is also an important part of it. For me, with collies, of course, you know, we had Albert Pacer Triumph's dogs or Lassie and things like that. But all those things that help you romanticize things about a breed, if it's all cut and dried and statistics and numbers, I think you burn out.
That is beautiful. And I'm going to let us close on that because I don't think I've ever heard anybody say it better. So thank you.
Good.
John, I really, really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.